Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the referenced paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the August episode of AZMcast. Are you tired of pus? Me too. Like, you have no idea. But we haven't yet gotten to the most important part: how to make sure that all of the techniques that we've described to get the pus out are successful and tolerable. These things hurt like crazy, and many people would rather just deal with the pain than to have us so much as touch their abscess with a feather. This is the answer to that question: how could you let this go so long? It's likely someone who has had an excruciating experience with an abscess IND once before that never wants to go through that again. So how do we make these as painless as possible? We'll cover the answer to that question, plus more of our patented random thoughts and musings, and a peer review on this month's episode of AZMcast. So why do we do all this stuff? I really think it's because we don't want to take the time to truly express all the pus and get it out. Why?
It hurts.
It hurts. It hurts like crazy. This whole area is inflamed, it's under pressure, and we try to convince ourselves that, don't worry, as soon as we get the pus out, you'll feel better. Well, that's not true. We know that's not true. And I know people that have had one bad experience, and they go, that's it, everybody gets ketamine, and we're making sure everybody's out because I can't deal with this. This is one of the reasons that most of us that have been doing this for a while avoid abscesses, because we hate the pus, right? We hate the pain that we put people through. And what do you get in return? Pus. Like, you don't get a satisfying outcome. No offense to those of you that like pus, but that's not a satisfying outcome to me, to have a patient screaming at me, crying, and I'm sitting here with a handful of pus, you know? That's not good. So how do you guys treat your pain?
I think when we are used to numbing up other parts of the body, say you're doing a laceration repair, you put the needle in the we're probably going a little too deep, but dermis, hypodermis, and numbing up there. Well, the abscess usually is pushing so hard on the superficial structures, you have such a thin wall that when you put the needle in there, you're kind of in the abscess, and you're not really numbing up the spot that you're just about to put a scalpel through. So it actually is fairly painful to inject into the epidermis. But I do that. I try to skive the needle just above the abscess, and I try to put, it's going to be difficult, but I'll try to put a fair amount of anesthetic right where I'm going to put the scalpel. It sounds stupid, but that's what we're doing. We're trying to numb up that spot that we're about to poke. It's a very superficial injection, because I'm not trying to just dump a bunch of fluid into the abscess. However, once I do that, I put a bunch of fluid into the abscess. Why do I do that? I'm making my target bigger, and I'm putting it under pressure. I want it under pressure so that I know when I get in there.
So it'll hit the wall behind you.
Yeah, well, wear the things you're supposed to wear. But I do that. So I'll put a bunch of anesthetic into the abscess pocket, and it's surfing me well.
Now, I've been told, and Chris, you might be able to validate this debunk this, but I've been told that lidocaine does not work well in an abscess because it's an acidic environment, and lidocaine does not work well when it's acidic.
I've heard the same thing.
You've heard the same thing? Okay,
I've heard
good.
The same thing.
So there's two turkeys. Right. Then.
That is very interesting because lidocaine itself is fairly acidic.
Right.
Four.
Really?
Yeah, so yeah. I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I think that there are a lot of reasons that might make lidocaine less effective, mm-hmm. particularly if it's injected into an abscess. Similar to what we were talking about earlier, where antibiotics aren't going to penetrate an abscess. If you just jam a needle into the abscess and start injecting lidocaine into all that pus, it's probably not going to get to the outside of that pus-filled area. Yeah. In order to make contact with the nerves and actually have an effect. But I like the idea of going in kind of from the side and trying to numb the surrounding area. I think that would probably be more efficacious.
So my take on this is, and I do the same thing. I numb the skin. You always use Lido with Epi for everything. Mm-hmm. There's only one anesthetic. It's Lido with Epi, but that's a different thing. Anyway, I numb the skin.
With Epi.
Nope, Lido with Epi. So I get the skin numbed. And then what I do, and this is, I've used ultrasound, so I've seen how deep the abscess is, and I start right where I'm going to cut, and I take the needle perpendicular and go, and I hub it, and I go deep. And I inject as much as I can deep, and then I will come out, and I will cut the abscess, I will get the initial pus out, and then I will go into the abscess and go deep all around. Because the nerves, right, for these come from below to the skin and abscess. So you have to block below the abscess. So the only way you're going to – and you can do it from the side, too, if it's smaller. If you're like, oh, I don't want to go through the, you know, abscess. Because we had to talk about, you can't put a needle through pus. That's sorry. But you can put a needle through pus because there's pus below, a pus below, you know, above and on the side. So if you're going right through it, you're not, like, seeding this space. There's already an abscess in there with pus, so it's – and bacteria. So – go down.
Unless you go through into another organ.
Right. Now, if you're going into the other organ or you're going into a joint, you know, that's a totally different thing. But if this is soft tissue, you know, someone's like leg or arm or something, you've got to get deep to it and get those nerves before they come up. That's the only time I have found that it works. Now, yeah, I do the occasional, like you drip a little lidocaine into the tissue, right? We do that sometimes just to see if it gets some time. I know. That's like holy water, but. Yeah.
What about the circumferential anesthetic? Sometimes, you know, you draw the diamond around the abscess and see. I've had some success doing that and getting some good anesthesia, but I don't know what you guys think.
I've not had it work that well. I'll tell you what I do is I have gotten to the point of where I just know no matter what I do, you are not going to get the pain relief that you would like from my local anesthetic. And I have kind of changed my expectations to I'm going to numb it so that you don't feel the cut of my scalpel.
Right.
That's right. Really my goal, because then I can make a generous enough incision that you are not going to, scream at me as I saw into your owie.
Yeah.
So I've tried a couple different things. One thing I've tried is topical lidocaine, like 4% LMX. And then my new favorite one, because sometimes it kills two birds with one stone, is the J-tip. So I will take the J-tip, which for those of you that may not have used it, it's a pressure-injected lidocaine, and it's got no needle to it whatsoever. It's just got a flat tip to it. It's under pressure, and you've got a little trigger with a safety. You put it right over top of that abscess, and you press the button and it sounds like a soda can, and it pressure injects the lidocaine as a wheel, which will at least numb the area where I'm going to make the incision, but sometimes it will pop the abscess for me.
It's like straight out of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very cool. And if it's generous, I've seen this thing just start pouring out pus and I'm like, well, there we go. Let's give it a little bit. This is great for patients who we talked about at the beginning of the podcast are IV drug users that don't are afraid of the pain. We go, this is the anesthetic and they don't want anything else. This is the anesthetic. We're just going to numb it up here. There's no needles to it. It's just going to shoot the anesthetic in there and they feel better that there's no needles. And I'm not going to lie, it still doesn't feel good, but nothing feels good, and it may accomplish it so quick that it's not like me holding a needle into their skin, and I'm worried it's going to go deep, they're going to get poked, I'm going to get poked, and we run into more issues there. So I really like the J-tip.
Maybe we talk about the IV drug user abscess, since you brought it up. Do they have different microbiology? Do they have their abscesses different? Do they need to be treated differently? Do we acquiesce to the hyperalgesia, and are we more prone to or inclined to ketamine them? I'm just curious on everyone's thoughts on the approach to the IV drug user with the abscess.
I end up not changing my approach too much, other than maybe I would, you know, we'll get to antibiotics for abscesses later, but I would recommend antibiotics in those patients a little bit more. I think so my approach also from the analgesia side is, this kind of dovetails into sedation, no sedation. I'm pretty heavy handed with lots of drugs, as you guys may have heard. A little bit. I occasionally use the pharmacy. So,
keeping the lights on for Chris.
That's right. That's
how I got invited to.
So I put an IV in most patients with an abscess, not for blood cultures, really for IV opiates. And I will, my ideal, if I could do anything, I would put these people on a dose of IV remifentanil, and I would put them on a remifentanil drip. And that has been the best treatment that I can find, but it's expensive. And Chris and I have done this a couple times, actually, here in the ER, and then we both got shot down because it was too expensive. But the experience is pretty good. If you don't have remifentanil, I would use fentanyl, and you can use fentanyl in higher doses than what you think. So the fentanyl, I usually start with 100, and I'll have maybe a second 100 or a third 100 at bedside. So the dose for fentanyl is 1 to 4 micrograms per kilogram. Most people are 70 kilograms. So if you start at 100, right, if we're going to say, and some of our patients are bigger than that, but you start at 100, that's a 1 to 2 microgram. You're right in that range. Another 100 is only going to put them to the 2 to 3. And what you're really doing, there isn't a lot of, right, these patients are amped up as it is. If it's an IV drug user in these cases, they're used to this anyway. They could have been using fentanyl as their drug of choice as is, but I want them to get high as snot so that I can do what I need to do. And that sometimes will save me the sedation. If I'm still worried, I will then add ketamine on top of the fentanyl to truly put them out to allow me to do what I need to do. But I think a lot of IV fentanyl is a useful tool to help with these patients.
It's an interesting approach. And like I said, we've done it a few times with fentanyl and tried to do it with remifentanil. Actually got an awesome story about a guy we just did ketamine for drainage of an abscess. He was an IV drug user. He had been put in a situation where he was getting drug tested frequently. I think he was on parole. And we were getting ready to do the sedation for him. And I started talking to him about ketamine. We were planning to use ketamine. And he got really excited. He's like, "You mean like human ketamine?" And I'm like, "Yep. Human ketamine." And then he's like, "Yeah, cool, because when I was getting drug tested, I was getting all this monkey ketamine from Mexico, and I had been using it like for about a year." And I was like, "Huh, okay, this is going to be interesting." So we give him the usual 1 mg per kilo, and he is totally coherent, but basically just going in slow motion. So he's having the time of his life on 1 mg per kg of ketamine and just like, "Oh, this is awesome." But he kept talking, you know, he's talking basically slow-mo. So he ended up getting quite a bit more ketamine in order to get the desired effect so that we could drain his antecubital abscesses. But yeah, just interesting riff.
Monkey ketamine.
Ketamine, yeah.
There's horse ketamine, too.
The canine ketamine. Yeah. You know, that's in the vet offices.
I think he actually specifically said simian ketamine. I was pretty impressed. Ooh. Yeah.
Intellectual.
It was in the bonobos. The
bonobos. Super psyched for the human stuff, though. But yeah, I mean, injection drug.
He knows it's not made from monkey, right? Or human, or it's not derived from the ketamine gland.
Jane Goodall ketamine.
That would have been an interesting question to ask. But yeah, no, this brings up an interesting point as well about, you know, sort of what organisms do you expect to see in patients with IV drug users, and does that change the anticipated pathogens? And there was an interesting study that Aaron sent out that kind of goes into this a little bit. And shockingly, the pattern is similar, but it's different enough that I think it should probably alter your management to a certain degree. So patients with IV history of IV drug use do tend to have MRSA infections, so somewhere around 47% of patients. They also had a fairly high incidence of strep, which is not common outside of IV drug use. So I think if you have that IV drug user and you're getting ready to send them home with some, and you decide that you want to send them home with some antibiotics, I think that you should take the typical microbiology that you're going to see in these patients into consideration, and consider adding something that's going to cover you for those strep species.
Yeah, so that's when I really like, instead of clindamycin, I like cefalexin and trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, because that's going to get your gram negatives, you know, it's going to get your strep. And I kind of wonder with this, I got to look into the paper more, if this was just like group A strep, or if this is peptostrep, if this is more, you know, kind of anaerobic flora. Maybe you licked your needle to keep it clean, and then you went to inject it. Right. I don't know. So
that never works. it looks like there was a variety of strep species that they reported out.
Group G, you know.
Ooh.
Now, I'm kind of with Brian about trying to get the IV drug user, especially when they use a lot of heroin, trying to get them fairly high in order to do this. And I've run into issues with nurses before about why are we getting this IV drug user high? And I understand that. However, I also know that if we don't get this patient adequately sedated and they leave AMA, they're going to come back with septic endocarditis, and they're going to be in the hospital for a much longer time. And if you only take it from the perspective of this patient is difficult and I don't want to deal with them, even then, you're going to deal with them a lot more when they come back sicker, because they're going to be really sick. So this is, as I said before, a golden opportunity to try to care for these patients that don't come to the ER very much. And so I'm not in the business of trying to be punitive when they're trying to make their case there. Now,
they're not drug seeking.
Right? No, they've got something real.
They're pain relief seeking.
They're pain relief seeking, and they are, exactly. Yeah. You want to reinforce good behavior, and good behavior is seeking medical attention when you've got an abscess like that.
And, you know, I'm not putting up for anybody swinging at me. I'm not putting up for anybody, assaulting the nurses. Like, we have a discussion of, like, we are going to treat your pain. That's right out in the open. I'm not here to harm you. I'm not here to cause you distress. This is a bad condition you have, and I'm really glad you came in for it. We're going to take care of you, okay? Let me know when you need more pain medicine. And then when it's done, you know, it's going to be done. We're going to have this taken care of. And hopefully it is a life lesson for them. If I can go to the ER, they're going to take care of me. So they don't come in with osteomyelitis, septic joint, all this weird stuff that they end up getting because they have weird infections.
And you know who knows abscesses really, really well? The IV drug user. And the most amazing thing I saw, I had a woman who was a multi-generational IV drug user. She had started using heroin, injectable heroin, when she was 13 years old. She learned it from her mother, who taught her how to do it. Her mother taught her. So she was a third generation IV drug user who's been, and her grandmother was still alive. Her mother was still alive. She was, I think she was.
Was her grandmother like 32?
I was going to say, they look older than stated age. She was covered in scars. And she says that when her mother had taught her how to cut abscesses with razor blades, and she says she came in because she had an abscess that was deeply infected. And so she knew it, and she said, this isn't one that I can just cut. This is a deeper infection. I need antibiotics. We got it opened up. We got it drained, and she said, okay, I want my antibiotics. I'm going to go. Like, no, this is like the admit kind of antibiotics, and she refused. She said, no, I know what you guys need to do, but this will be fine. I just need my oral antibiotics, and she went home. But if you ever needed proof that abscesses do not need antibiotics, that's three generations of proof right there. They do not get antibiotics unless they are systemically ill, and all of their abscesses had healed wonderfully. I didn't ask about tetanus, whether their family kept up to date on tetanus or not. She was up to date.
Nobody in their family, yeah. And no one in their family died of tetanus?
And no one in their family died of tetanus.
Interesting. So who do you give antibiotics to post-IND?
I used to do nobody, and then Dave Talon had written an article talking about Bactrim use in post-IND. And so after hearing this, it's now become a shared decision-making component that I do with patients. So it's not always guaranteed. You know, in his article, I think he talked about maybe about a 7 to 8% different cure rate. So even in patients without antibiotics, they were still, I think, curing 73% of the time. And then with antibiotics, it was like 80% of the time. So there are side effects to antibiotics. So there's harms, right? So the benefits and harms, I weigh that with the patient. And I talk to them about these. And, you know, I give them some percentage. I said, it's probably going to do well either way. There's probably a little bit better chance and give them percent. But there could be harms. Maybe, you know, you're going to get C. diff. Maybe you're going to get some diarrhea. Maybe you get allergic reaction or some other side effect from this medicine. Do you have a preference? I can always write you this script and you decide not to fill it, or you can fill it in a couple days. I'll do that. So I do it as a discussion with them. But there was a time where I did no antibiotics at all. And I think there's some articles that Aaron's going to include here that also show most, as Chris is saying here, abscesses do well without antibiotics. The key is debridement. And to get a good debridement, as we're hitting on before, good analgesia, because that will stop you when someone's yelling or screaming at you. So that's my take with antibiotics.
So we have an article here that Aaron's going to post, that a multi-center study that was done across the country, over 750 patients were involved in this, both adults and kids, and they compared IND versus IND with either Bactrim or Clinda, and found that, at least in the short term, the group that had IND, and these are just simple abscesses, this isn't an abscess with cellulitis, this is just straight up simple abscess, the group with IND plus antibiotics did better in the short term. They measured short term at 10 days and 1 month. And so I have been kind of feeling like that for a while anyway. I've been giving antibiotics to most of my abscesses for about a year now. But I do believe that if you IND and don't give antibiotics, they do fine. So why am I giving antibiotics? Because I think they do fine faster. That's why.
And that's the whole purpose of giving medication, is to derive a benefit. What you don't want to do is give a medication that has a higher risk for harm and has little benefit. So if it's the same, then why are we charging? Why are they doing the cost, the potential side effects? But if there's an effect, then go for it. Now, here's the interesting thing that goes a little bit counter to this, is we're doing antibiotics, but we're not getting a culture, because that's pretty well described, is don't get a wound culture for a simple abscess. It's part of the Choosing Wisely campaign that ACEP came out with, is said, don't get a wound culture for a simple cutaneous abscess. You don't need it. Just give the antibiotics and walk away. But there's pus. We have pus. Every bacteria, everything you'd want to know is right sitting there in that pus. We're just going to throw it away.
Yes.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay, all right, moving on.
When I was a resident, I remember getting in so much trouble for not culturing any wound that I opened. Like, why would you not do that? But it's just interesting. I mean, it was a while ago. It wasn't that long ago. But now it's totally different.
Cultures are $250 a pop. I mean, it's real money. They don't change outcomes. You know, the chance of you even getting a culture that's positive is also low. You know, and a lot of these are polymicrobial. Then did you actually get the right culture? There's lots of problems with these tests. So you have to, you know, you have to understand, if you're ordering that, what, you know, rabbit hole you're going down, because it's not a fun one.
Definitely.
Not the blue pill.
And I think we have a pretty good idea of what we're going to find in there. So, you know, the majority of these purulent abscesses have Staph aureus in there. And if we send them out on an agent that has activity against methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, chances are we're going to cover it. So if we can save the patient $250, we can save the people doing the culture follow-up phone calls a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
Could sell an incubator and maybe, you know, buy some more nurses.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is your chance of getting a contaminated sample and finding something really bizarre that ends up causing this patient to have to come back and get started on some weird antibiotics for something that's not actually causing a problem. It's also there. It's also a real possibility. So something to keep in mind.
So that's the principle that we hope you've, if you listen to this podcast regularly, it's one of the principles of diagnostic medicine we hope that you get, is don't order a test that's not going to change your management. So yes, we can tell you probably what the pus is that's in there, but if you're going to get better with or without antibiotics, as long as you get the pus out, it's a test that doesn't change your management. I mean, we could MRI your abscess and define the discrete borders and know exactly the size, but it's not going to change your management. So don't order a test. It's not going to change your management. Sometimes you might order the test and it's going to change your management because you're going to tap out and you're going to say, you know what, this is more than I can handle. I'm calling a surgeon. What makes you guys tap out and say, This is more than I can handle? Is it location? Is it size? Is it comorbidities? What kind of things give you pause before you're going to go in and shiv the patient?
To this day, I still can't explain why I did this. How many times have I ordered a CT angio for an abscess evaluation? Once in my life. And I don't know what it was about the patient that made me do it, but this person had an abscess in their AC. He swore, and he did not look like an IV drug user, not that we should know what one looks like, but he didn't, and he swore up and down he didn't use IV drugs.
Didn't have the stigmata of IV drugs.
And he didn't have stigmata, by the way, so. But he
That requires an old priest and a new priest.
And this is what I was working about, you know, in Texas, and we did not have an ultrasound machine either, so I didn't have the ability to ultrasound this, okay, so. Yeah. So but it was in the AC joint, and I could see the abscess. I could see where it was. I could feel it. I'm just like, you know, I don't know where it goes. Now, how many times have we seen an abscess that's like involving a blood vessel? This wasn't pulsatile, but it was really tight, really tight. I ordered a CT angio on this abscess, and sure enough, it actually communicated with the brachial artery. So I called a surgeon for that one. And I can't tell you why I didn't cut into it, but had I cut into it, this guy would have been tourniqueted, and I still would have called a surgeon. So I wouldn't have changed the dispo at all.
Interesting. It would have changed your shorts.
It would have changed a lot of things, though. Absolutely.
Now, Al Fiorello has talked about a couple times where he's ultrasounded these antecubital abscesses and found that there is a calcified vessel right in the middle, which is a septic thrombophlebitis that needs to be incised by a surgeon. And so there are some of these times where you're going to do the ultrasound, it's going to change your management because it's not a simple abscess. It's an abscess and a fistula. It's an abscess and a infected clot or nidus, or there's a foreign body in there like a needle tip or a tooth or whatever it happens to be that needs a surgeon to go in and get it out under fluoroscopy or under extensive exploration that we don't have the skill, don't have the time, or don't have the equipment to do in the ED.
I think what you said before, though, size and location are probably the... I mean, we know the special areas that we probably need to have surgeons for. We've already talked about perirectal abscesses, but hands are another one. I mean, aside from flexor tenosynovitis, which is basically just hand pus, but areas where you know you need somebody with specialization to actually get out all of the pus, as we talked about before, and that's really what you need is good clearance of the pus, and sometimes you just can't do that by yourself at the bedside. And size is another one. I've definitely called surgery when I've had I remember this patient very clearly, back of her arm, I think she was a skin popper, but it was just literally her entire triceps area from her deltoid down to her elbow was just huge and fluctuant, and I just knew that there wasn't any way I was going to get good pain control, anesthesia, and good control of that abscess at the bedside. And most of the time when you call, they don't hesitate to take them to the OR.
My decision tree is follow up. So if I think this person's going to follow up with me or follow up in the ED or the urgent care system, I'm not calling a surgeon. But if I think this patient has to see a surgeon post IND, then I want the surgeon to see the patient now and let them, because you know what they don't like doing? They don't like taking care of your surgical wound.
That's right.
They want to be the ones to do the create the surgical wound. Maybe in the community. Especially if you have a rapport with your surgeons and they understand what you're able to do, and they also understand that you are saving them time by doing the IND yourself, it's okay to do the IND in a really large area if you can call the surgeon and say, hey, I'll do the IND for you, but I need you to see this person like in one to two days, that might be the caveat. But in our academic system, I would just call the surgeons. If it's an abscess, you need the surgeons to see in a few days.
Yeah, I think the same thing. I've gotten in big abscesses, which I, you know, the first time you do it, you're kind of like, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. And it just like it kept going. Mm-hmm. And, you know, big, like, butt abscesses. I think initially in my career, scrotal abscesses, I was always worried that this was neck fasc. I now have a better appreciation. I think even sometimes you call the surgeon and they come down and show you, this is what I'm looking for, this is how I would handle it, has allowed me to expand what abscesses I feel comfortable taking care of, as opposed to what times I would call them. So I think that even early in your career, you may not feel comfortable, but say you're calling your surgeon like, hey, could you come down and show me how you would approach this? If you think this can be done at bedside, show me. And then that right now I don't have to call you at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's helpful for them. But I also think, as Allie pointed out, if you think one of these abscesses is something that just is not going to get good adequate sedation, and it would best be done in an OR, even for like area, just right, you can't get a good visualized, Chris was mentioning this pannus earlier, like this is going to be very difficult to access, whereas if I can, you know, put the patient down completely and then manipulate the patient into the right position with the right tools, those are other times that I would call them.
Yeah, mine is usually a combination of size and location. So abscesses, not just like zits, but abscesses on the ear get me concerned, because you can get an infection of the cartilage, and that has a high cosmetic consequence if you don't get that right. Abscesses on the anterior neck that are sizable, and I'm wondering, okay, where is this going? Abscesses that are on the anterior, that are on the abdomen, make me a little bit concerned as well when they're sizable. Because again, I'm like, oh gosh, I know I can cut this, but how deep am I going? Right. And how deep is this thing, you know, going to track? And then when you just look at something, you just kind of know, your clinical haggis goes, that thing is huge.
Right.
They're gonna need more time and effort to really get all the pus out than I can afford to do in the ED. It's not that I don't want to take care of the patient. It's I have an entire ED of patients I'm caring for simultaneously, and just the way things are going, I can't afford all the time it's going to take to get this done. I need to call for backup. So that I think that's appropriate utilization of your resources. When you say, look, I would love to take care of this patient, but I've got several chest pain patients that are in workup right now. I've got a stroke. I've got, you know, I've got a fracture I need to reduce. I've got plenty of other things that are within my scope. And this is kind of bordering on, this is going to take me an hour and a half to do. I just can't, you know. Will you please help me out with that? And again, that may be a little different in the community versus here. Maybe a little different depending on who your consultant is. But I found that to be a pretty good barrier as well, as far as who I when I'm going to call and when I'm not. I think we're going to let the sun set on the pus from this conversation.
I hear the Elton John song should come in right here.
Which one is that?
Hello, this is Grant Roper, University of Arizona, class of 2013. I work in Western Colorado in Grand Junction in a fairly small level 3 trauma center, 14 beds, see about 50 patients a day. And I have been asked to comment on the conversation about abscesses. First thing I'd like to clear up, whether I like pus or not, I'm going to go with no, but it's so rare that we encounter problems in the emergency department that we can actually fix on our own. And this is one that we can often fix on our own, so I do like that aspect of it. Regarding pilonidals, this is probably the only place that I pack with any regularity. I agree with the panel regarding antibiotics. Super rare that I would treat with an antibiotic. Only if there was clear evidence of cellulitis expanding significantly from the initial lesion. Bartholin's, certainly a challenge for pain control. The very first, or at least the first one that I remember, was at the U of A, and I did not achieve adequate pain control. And when I incised the lesion, the patient's knees came abruptly shut, and purulent drainage was expelled across the room. I have kind of a Matrix memory of this, of kicking sideways and sliding with the stool and a bunch of goop striking the privacy curtain behind me. It might not have shaken out exactly like that, but that's how I remember it. My therapist says it's accurate. So, when I approach these now, these patients get 0.1 to 0.2 mg per kg of ketamine. I don't know why I say 0.1 to 0.2. That's what the directions say. I don't think I've ever given anyone 0.1 per kilo of ketamine. And honestly, usually I just give them 20. But either way, I give them subdissociative ketamine, 100 of fentanyl. And that typically works really well. I'm not a fan of the word catheter. I guess I'm just not good at it. They always fall out. They don't seem to be helpful to me. So I give them instructions to sit in a warm bath four times a day to keep it open and to follow up closely with gyne. Perirectal lesions. If I have any question, if it's very close to the dentate line, I'll just get a CT scan. They're easy to get in our shop. I don't like to CT everything just because I can, but this is one where if I need a tiebreaker, I just get it so that I know what I'm dealing with. And if it's not a true perirectal abscess that's tracking proximally, then I drain them by and large. I have a surgery team that is very happy to follow up with my patients, and they're even happier to not come to my ER. So I don't worry much about follow-up in these cases. They tend to reliably get it, and typically I can handle them unless it is a true perirectal abscess with a positive Chris Williams sign. Let's say a positive C-dub sign, I think, would be the more appropriate way to carry that forward, and I can only hope that it joins the ranks of Babinski and Dix Hallpike, as well as the other very wonderful eponyms that live within our specialty. The positive C-dub sign. I look forward to eliciting that as soon as possible in my next appropriate patient. MRSA coverage. I don't have a lot of MRSA abscesses here in Grand Junction. I don't pretend to be good enough to spot one just by looking at it. I suppose if there were 10 lined up, I could pick the ugliest ones and call them MRSA, but typically I just approach it with, I don't know what this is, as far as the causative agent. Because the prevalence here is lower, I tend to treat with cephalexin, unless they report a history of being MRSA positive, and then I will assume that it's MRSA. But cephalexin is what I start with, unless there's a contraindication, and I go from there. I nearly always use an ultrasound to determine if I'm going to perform an incision and drainage on an abscess. There are some that are obvious, right? And I just cut those as long as I'm not concerned about the anatomical location and potential collateral damage from my knife. But yeah, ultrasound almost every time. And that does help me if I'm working in a delicate place like the neck or the anacubital fossa, or anywhere else that makes me paranoid. Either way, I see it, I can see where it starts, where it stops, what's in there, if anything, and typically the procedure is much more successful if I use ultrasound. So I do. Regarding local anesthesia, I will infiltrate lots of lido with epi. Typically, I'll just start with a 10cc syringe, and very often I'll unload the entire syringe. I will make a pass over the top of the abscess and just watch it blanch out over the area that I'm going to incise. And then I will run a deeper incision similar to what Brian described. And then the last will go into the abscess pocket itself. And honestly, I almost always have very good anesthesia. They may wince a little bit when I'm lysing all of the pockets inside, but for the most part, I can get good anesthesia with these. Regarding follow-up, I do not tell people as a blanket policy to return in 2 days for a wound check. I know a lot of people do. Unless I have a reason to question my patient's ability to tell if they're getting better or worse, I will tell them that if they are not getting better or if they're getting worse, for example, if the redness is tracking up their arm, etc., then I'll tell them to come back for a wound check. But otherwise, if it's getting better, they don't need me to tell them that it's getting better. Do the warm soaks, complete the antibiotics, and go from there. I typically do treat with antibiotics, and I was influenced, like some of the guys on the panel, with the data that's come out in the past couple of years showing that people tend to do better faster, even though they probably would do just fine with incision and drainage only. So I do tend to send people out with a 5-day course of cephalexin. And again, you know, I will think about MRSA coverage if they have significant risk factors or if they report a personal confirmed history of it. So that's my 2 cents on abscesses and pus and the like. Lovely conversation. I'm happy, very, very happy to have been able to be a part of it.